All right, C++ world again. Herb, how are you?
Hey, how are you doing, Charles? Good to see you again.
Doing great. It's been a while. It's less sunny. What's going on?
I don't know. I don't know if June's ever really going to start around here. They keep saying it's going to.
I really liked filming outside, by the way.
It was nice.
Yeah.
Hey, you know, after our last interview,
yeah.
I noticed that in the comments that there were some people who were saying you were going a bit easy on me with the questions.
Yes.
They say, why didn't you ask about X, Y, and Z? And I know there's only so much we can do in 30 or 45 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
But so that's why, as you may know, this is a follow-up, because I decided to blog about it and say, ask me anything.
Excellent.
And about 100 people or so did, and then voted each other's answers up and down. So we're not going to be able to get to all 100 questions, but
yeah.
Hopefully to some of the more highly voted ones that people want to know about. So
absolutely,
I'll say what I can.
Yes, and you were very open from the beginning that we were going to ask the highest rated, so please vote. One of the people out there, Joshua Burkholder, I think he voted a little too high for himself, but we're not going to start there.
We'll get to that.
We'll start with the real highest rated. And that's an excellent question from the name here is Pinkawa, I believe is how you pronounce it. And he wants to know, which non-C++ language do you find to be the most inspiring today? Are there any features in that language that you'd like to see in future C++ incarnations?
So that's an interesting question. So I was thinking about that a little bit because I was reading the questions on my blog and I thought, what to say? Because I can't think of a specific language. There are features in various languages that I find very interesting. Clojure and its approach to lock-free data structures, all sorts of things like that. Functional languages and the way that they deal with closures and they deal with lambdas. But one thing that I really would love to see in C++, two things come to mind, and I'll talk about one of them, and that is safety, type and memory safety. Now, putting that in context, I think we covered this a little last time, mostly C++ is already type safe. We happen to be C compatible, so a lot of the stuff comes in that back door, right?
Uh-huh.
So you have your reinterpret casts, you have your type unsafe unions and things like that that let you pun types. So safety and security. And at this point, maybe people will be thinking, oh, well, we have languages for that. We have C#, we have Java, we have all sorts of other type-safe and memory-safe languages, and I agree. But there's a big difference, because C's big claim to fame, and the reason Dennis Ritchie deserves a Turing Award that he got was because he did something they said couldn't be done. He created a high-level language that was portable at high performance, leaving no room for a language lower than assembler. It was really a portable assembler. They said it couldn't be done, and Dennis went and did it. And we can niggle about the C declaration syntax and other things that didn't work out so well, but it's really important to recognize those are side experiments that were details in a much larger thing that he accomplished.
Mm.
So this portable systems language, that you could actually do this, get close to the metal in a portable language. Nobody thought it could be done, and he did it. Now, advance another decade. 1979, early 1980s, Bjarne is working at Bell Labs, and he is working on C++, first C with classes in C++, and what he accomplished there was to take a systems programming language that was portable with strong abstractive power, especially classes and templates. He proved that you could actually do a portable systems programming language with strong abstraction and typing, strong typing.
Mm.
That was a major advance. It will be really interesting to see, and I would love to see somebody tackle the challenge of demonstrating that you can create a portable systems language, meaning it has performance equal to C, C++, Fortran, that is portable, type safe, and also memory safe. That to add that on top of classes and templates and the portability of C, to add strong type safety, which requires a form of garbage collection, and not leave performance on the table, not leave room for a language lower than C or C++ or whatever that language is. That'll be something. Because C++ did it without leaving room for a language lower than itself. People use C, but it's not because C++ doesn't let you get down to the metal. It's because they prefer a different language. Can it be done to have safety and security and leave no room lower? That will be the first strong competition to C++ on its home turf, if anybody creates another such language. But if C++ evolves there, that will be an interesting thing. Now, you can already do that in a subset of C++, but it'll be interesting to see, can you build build this thing mm-hmm. that is type and memory safe and systems performance all the way. It'll be an interesting experiment.
Absolutely. Now, that actually kind of leads nicely into a question from Matthias Merkers, who asks really about tool support in C++ and sort of the, when we see about sort of the advent of these new quote-unquote system languages like Go and D. D, of course, is a systems language, probably more so than Go, but you can tell people what systems language means. But he was really asking about, so do you think the lacking tool support for C++, assuming it's true that it's lacking tool support, will be a major problem since there are new, better prepared system programming languages available? He used Go as an example of a
Indeed.
Better prepared. Indeed.
So there's a couple of things there. Let me tease that one apart, because the way I'm hearing it, there's a few keywords. So you're already targeting systems programming language. It's important to understand that Go is a very interesting language. I think it does a lot of things really well. In fact, one of the things it does, which is the second thing I mentioned earlier I would love to see C++ do, mm-hmm. is go to a complete left-to-right declaration syntax and expression syntax. Go went at least to the declaration syntax left-to-right. Mm-hmm. And once you make that decision, you're going to spell Pascal. You just are going to end up in the same place as Pascal. It's just whether your var and function keywords are going to be spelled a little differently, or whether your pointer is going to be a hat is going to be a little different. But you have only one place to go. And that's a good thing, because the left to right makes you end up in a place where you have no ambiguities. You can read your code in a much more straightforward way, which also makes it more toolable. Mm. Right? So there's a benefit there. But Go is not a systems programming language in the sense that we talk about C and C++. Mm-hmm. I know they use that term, and what they have in mind is distributed systems, data, all the data centers that you have, and that kind of environment. It seems to be well suited for systems programming language for getting close to the metal, high performance and optimization. That's not its intent, as from what I know about it. D, on the other hand, does have that intent, but they didn't make the simplifying syntax changes that Go did, which would make it more toolable, although it is still a simpler language than C++. Mm. So are those more toolable? Yes, only one of them is a systems programming language in the way that we talk about it. But are they toolable? Yes. It does cost more to create C++ tools because the language is more complicated. Mm. It does have more exceptions and special cases, and so compilers have to work harder to parse the language. And so do programmers, no question. Having said that, it's a relative thing. C++ has strong tool support today. Yes, it's a pain to add more things like refactoring that are easier in other languages. But apart from things like that and the speed at which you can create tools, we have been doing it for a decade or three, and we have strong tool support today, especially in Visual Studio 2010. Mm-hmm. Our previous release, we added some really nice tools in IntelliSense mm-hmm. and in the on-demand parsing and compilation and the quality of error messages. We did a lot of work there. Red squigglies, just like in a Word document. Oh, you misspelled that for C++ code. Mm-hmm. We have it. We're shipping it today. So we're really proud of that. Does C# do us one better because it's a simpler language? Yeah, it does. Mm-hmm. That's kind of embarrassing, but it's not an all or nothing thing. So we do have strong tools. We're building even stronger tools. And if we find a way to simplify C++ in a way that makes it more toolable, great. Languages that are simpler do have an advantage there. But also, if they're starting from zero, they have some catch-up to do before they come to that quality. But definitely, velocity is interesting, but it doesn't mean that C++ is a tool-unfriendly language. We have some very strong tools today, and not just from Microsoft.
Excellent. So, sticking with the sort of broader questions, and then we're going to go deeper and deeper, get more narrow and narrow. The question is by Zenju. I like to call out their names, and mm-hmm. they do have identities. What is the strategy to deal with C++ language and standard library design flaws in the long run? So you make a mistake. How do you deal with that? Do you worry? He asks, are you afraid bad design decisions, and he puts it in quotes for a reason, mm-hmm. may accumulate over time, thereby making it more and more harder for newbies to learn the language?
Yes. Absolutely, yes. If we're not afraid of that, then we should be. Something's wrong.
Okay.
So let me try to answer that from the point of view of not just Microsoft, but also WG21, the ISO C++ committee, and I'm sure that what I'm going to say is the opinion of many people there. Absolutely, we are concerned about that. Many in committee discussions have been, how can we make the language simpler? How can we additively make the language simpler? Because, for example, if you look at many C++OX features like auto and decal type, like initializer lists, they add new features to the language. That means if you look at the language as a whole, there's more to learn. But it means you can ignore certain parts. It means your code gets easier to write because you have more convenient ways of expressing your intent. You can write a one-line lambda expression instead of writing a 10-line functor, most of which is boilerplate. You can write auto instead of spelling out a long type. You can do those kinds of things. So certainly sometimes adding features can make things simpler. But it is absolutely true that success is a cruel master, because the more users you have, and C++ has more users out there than almost any other language on the planet, if you need to treat them right and you need to respect that. There's a very large, very high compatibility bar. So in the standard, let's say that something was done in C++ that we, 10 years on, wish we'd done differently. We have examples of that. We have the export template feature. What we did with that in the second C++ standard, which is now in its final ballot, the C++OX or C++11, we actually removed it. We didn't just deprecate it. We removed it out of the standard. Individual vendors who implemented it, which is basically only Edison Design Group, they can continue to support that for however long for compatibility with their users. But the standard has said, you know, we made a mistake. We're going to take it out. It's not ready to be in the standard. And we removed it wholesale. Another example, which is probably the only other language feature in C++ that, with the benefit of hindsight, wasn't the right design, was exception specifications. It was really nice that you could say throws A, B, C and say those are the three types of exceptions a function could throw. And it turns out, to make a long story short, that if you go into dynamically checked exception specifications like C++ did, you encounter one set of problems. And then people say, well, you should have done it the Java way and had checked exceptions that are statically checked, and then you just have a different set of problems. And my personal belief is nobody has solved this problem yet in any language. There are problems with both ways. So the advice in the C++ community for exception specifications was don't use them, except maybe the empty one. And that was, I've written that as the question alluded to. I think it was that question or another question asked specifically about exception specifications. So maybe I'm jumping ahead. I just remember from reading it on the
blog. That's great. No, it works.
What do we do about that? What we did is deprecated them. Didn't remove them. So they're deprecated, which means a conforming implementation must still support that syntax. But we're putting people on notice that they may be removed in a future version of the standard. We replaced them and completely took them out of the standard library and replaced them with a new feature called NoExcept, which is a simpler form of exception specification that has a few different features. And let me just segue to that, because it's an example both of how do you fix things and of that other question.
Excellent.
About NoExcept. NoExcept is most similar to throw paren paren, throw nothing. But it's different in a few ways. First of all, you can't say what types it throws. You can just say throws something or throws nothing. So it's a lot simpler that way. You have to do a lot less type checking and cascading checks and that kind of thing in the implementation. But furthermore, it's much easier to implement with high performance, because basically there are many ways to implement it. But if you took a look at exception specifications, you mostly had to write for an exception specification. The compiler mostly had to write a try catch dot dot dot. There are other ways, but that's conceptually what it had to do, which can add some expense on some implementations, including our 32-bit exception specification or exception handling implementation. Instead now, you can implement NoExcept, that's widely believed on all compilers when we discuss this in committee, with basically a single bit on the stack frame, if you didn't have it already, that says whether an exception is active, and a single test. If exception is active, then terminate. That is a much simpler model to reason about. It is a much simpler model to implement, and it deals with most of the problems of exception specifications. So there you got two for one, because they were related questions.
Absolutely.
But what do we do? Well, we have backed out two features, notably export and exception specifications. There are a couple more, like we deprecated AutoPointer and replaced it with a superior set of smart pointers that cover the same space and more, instead of having one pointer type that tries to be all singing, all dancing, and do too many jobs. So there have been a few changes like that, but the good news is, by and large, we haven't had to change most things. The fact that I can even list the things that we corrected mostly on one hand, in terms of what features didn't pan out and had to be replaced, tells you something about the quality of standard C++. So we're mostly happy about it. But yes, compatibility is a constraint. We don't want to break people. When we do it in a backward compatible way with a migration path and providing either getting rid of features nobody was using or providing better alternatives for features that we now understand better 10 years on.
Excellent. Excellent answer, man. So now we're going to move on to Corey. Corey asks, was the person who started asking, I think, among the first set of questions. And they're really good questions, all of them highly rated. And the first one is one that you didn't want to answer in our conversation. So now Corey gets to ask.
I don't remember.
This is concepts.
Oh, concepts. Well, the only reason I didn't want to answer it was because it would take a half an hour and we only had so much time.
Exactly, and you said as much. So
right,
to be fair,
yeah.
I'm sort of playing. So Corey asks, concepts. Mm-hmm. Why do they fail? And what work is being done to bring something like them back in a future iteration of the standard?
Happy to answer that. Do not want to appear to be in avoiding a question, but this is an interesting one. And so let me try to give it in a nutshell, because concepts is a big, huge feature.
Sure.
I mean, the concepts proposal is not a small thing. It was a almost 100-page proposal to the standard.
Wow.
Like, it would have extended the standard by something like 10%.
Wow.
Just by itself. It was far bigger than all of the rest of templates combined.
Hmm.
So that... we're not talking about a small feature here, and that's why, you know, there's a lot that can be said about it.
Sure.
The short answer, in a nutshell, and then I'll expand on it, is that they weren't baked enough, and people couldn't agree on the design or that we really knew it would work. And if you don't know that it's going to work and you don't have high confidence, then it does not belong in an international treaty, because a standard is an international treaty. And we really ought to be sure that things work before we require legally that the world implement them.
Mm.
So we were very optimistic about concepts because it's a feature which, if you haven't seen it before, basically says, as Bjarne would put it, it lets you express a type system for templates. Or another way, I write a template that takes template parameters T and U, and I get to say, oh, by the way, T must be able to do the following things, and U must be able to do these other things. T must sing, and U must dance, and then I can separately type check that against all uses. I can separately, when I compile the template itself, without even knowing any particular instantiation, I know whether I wrote the template correctly. So there's a lot to be said for it, and there's a benefit. The mere fact that it took more to express that simple idea, which is simple in principle, than all the rest of templates in all their detailed glory combined, is a sign that something wasn't quite right. The fact that we took the standard library, and it took, I think it was something like 133, I forget the exact number, but it was over 100, I think, concepts, individual concepts, using the feature now in the library to express the standard library, shows that something wasn't quite right. So there was a lot of angst also about performance. We did actually have a compiler, so Doug Gregor put a lot of effort into extending GCC, into concept GCC, to add concepts as a proof of concept. Gabriel Dosres also extended GCC for a different version of concept, so work was done.
Mm.
But the best compiler anybody produced as a prototype was somewhere an order of magnitude slower for compiling STL programs, which means if you take your existing code that uses STL, that uses the standard library, I should say, and you recompiled it on the fastest concept-enabled compiler with a conceptized standard library, it was several times slower.
Wow.
Nobody could commercially ship a compiler the customers would accept that is, you know, a factor of 2x or 4x slower than the previous release. It's just not commercially marketable. A lot of customers are already maxing out build times and trying to do overnight builds that they do on build farms, and they take 8 hours, and they can't have that become 36 hours because they upgraded to a new compiler when it was 8 before. It won't work. Now, it was a prototype. We expect prototypes will be slow. They won't be perfect. But the fact that nobody knew whether it was possible to implement concepts as specified in the draft standard a couple of years ago with sufficient performance to actually be usable in anybody's compiler was a big warning sign and created a lot of discomfort. So between that, it was a very big specification, it had unknown performance characteristics, nobody knew if you could create a viable implementation that had sufficient performance, and that its use of the standard library was really complicated, it made people step back and say, you know what, we don't know if we even think we know how to use this feature. We don't know if it's the right one. Let's take it back out. It's still alive. People are still doing work. In fact, I can confirm that Bjarne Strustrup just sent me a draft about a week ago of a paper that he and a colleague are writing about concepts and bringing it forward. Interest has not gone away, but it needs more bake time before it deserves to be in an international standard, an international treaty, because you want to make sure it works and that you know how to use it before you say that this is something ready for the world, ready for prime time. So those are the main issues that were involved, and it's still something that's very important, but we need to make sure we know how to do it right, and people are still working on it, so I look forward to seeing what they come up with.
Excellent. So continuing on with Corey, his next question is about verbose lambdas.
You should have seen them before we proposed the simplified syntax. If you think these are verbose, let's not go there. Go look at the Lambdas talk. There's a couple of my Lambdas talks that are now online. One was from Channel 9 from PDC. The other one I gave at Northwest C++ Users Group. Just check my blog, herbsutter.com. Search it for Lambdas, and you'll find the two videos. And part of the slides is see how bad it was before. So if you think it's ugly now, well, we saved you a little bit. But it could be better. I agree.
Okay, so the Lambdas we have right now are very nice, but verbose compared to C#. So this is going to be a comparison thing. Polymorphic lambdas could have helped solve this.
Yes.
Again, why did they fail, and what work is being done to bring something like them back? This is question. So what happened to polymorphic lambdas in your committee meetings?
So the short version is that polymorphic lambdas are a great idea. We will probably do them in a future language. But if we made lambda functions polymorphic, for consistency, we ought to make all functions polymorphic. Now, what that means for those who aren't familiar with polymorphic lambdas is all it means is that for the parameter list, when you write a function void f and it takes an int and a float or something like that, instead of writing two specific parameter types, if you could just say auto parameter 1, auto parameter 2, just figure out what the type should be. We can do that in C++ by making it a template. And we make a template type name, T type name, U, and the parameters are T and U as their types. Bjarne actually proposed, and it almost got standardized, that we allow auto as parameter types, so that basically you could get a nicer syntax for writing templates. They would be implicit templates. If we did that for lambda functions, it would simply mean the function call operator, every time you invoke it, is implicitly a template. It's absolutely technically feasible. We know how to do it. And the only reason we didn't do it in the standard, there may have been other reasons in discussion. I wasn't in every discussion, but the ones I remember specifically were gulp. We really want to be consistent. If we do it for lambda functions, why don't we do it for all functions? And that part of the auto decal type proposal had been already cut a year or two earlier and not accepted because people were scared of allowing auto parameter types, implicit templates, will people know what they're getting? And people were kind of antsy about that, so they rejected that already. Then when lambdas came along, it was more tempting to do. If we had lambdas already, it might have succeeded because it's more tempting to do that for lambda functions because you only get to write them once. But because we already had said no to these and it was deemed too late in the process, we said, okay, we'll do monomorphic now. And if we allow auto as parameter types, we'll allow them in lambdas and in non-lambdas, and that will be a very nice marquee feature for C++ post-OX. But that's the reason it didn't get it in. Now, it's true, if you allow polymorphic lambdas, lambdas become even shorter, especially the parameter list. They're already pretty usable today. They're already on par, I argue, with C# today, except you have to type the parameter type names. And you get all the usability today, so I think it's still pretty good. But polymorphic lambdas will make it better in the future.
Awesome. So now let's, of course, Jalf asked the same question, so you just got two of the same questions answered.
Okay.
Jalf asked, also high rated, so this is apparently was important. So just to say, call Jalf out, he did ask about polymorphic lambdas. Why didn't we get them? You just answered them, so Corey and Jalf are happy amongst all the people that voted for it. How about, just quickly, when you were talking about no except, that was actually Ben Craig, and he was talking about a controversy over no except, specifically on destructors. Your book describes your reasoning on why destructors should never throw.
Okay.
And Ben wants to know, what does the opposition consider to be a valid use of throwing in destructors?
Well, it's always good in a debate to be able to take either side. So my side is destructors should never throw. Just don't do it. And it's been widespread and commonly accepted practice for some time. Nevertheless, the C++ allows you to do it. So what if you have a destructor that does throw? The proposal that was made was to say, we have this feature called no except. This is one of our big opportunities to make a change in the language. Should we make the default, not on all destructors, but just the default on destructors be, I don't throw? That's, I think most people would agree that's a safe default. That's the way things should be written. Because if you have a type whose destructor throws, what are you going to do with the object that the destructor throws? You can't try again. Yeah. The whole point of a function throwing an exception means I couldn't do what I was supposed to do. Now, granted, destructors can fail some of their sub-operations, but they can't fail to destroy the object. After it runs, even if it throws, you can't touch the object. It's in an indeterminate state. It's just random bits. There's no way you can try again. Mm-hmm. So given that, the correct design pattern, whether or not destructors are no except by default, the right thing to do is if a destructor or if the shutdown of an object could fail or some part could fail and you want users to be able to test that, always have a separate close function and the destructor calls close if it hasn't been closed already. You can call it something else besides close, but that's the idea. That way, anybody who just says, I'm done using the object, it closes and the destructor calls close, but then swallows any exceptions and does not throw. And anybody who does care about failures in shutting down and closing something can explicitly call close as a member function which you can retry. Mm-hmm. And so that's a much better model to follow anyway. Now, given that, why not just make destructors no throw? I know of no good reason why. I don't agree with the reasons that were given for not doing it. I think, but let me argue the other side now.
Okay.
The other side was, some people did research and found code bases which did in fact have throwing destructors. So if we made destructors no except by default, it would break those code bases when recompiled on a standards conforming compiler. And in particular, it would cause them, they were relying on an exception being thrown from the destructor, it would mean that if that actually happened, the program would terminate. I personally didn't find that convincing because I believe only one example was ever found. Most people who looked at it agreed, I'll characterize it this way, that it was not a good design and it had other problems anyway. But be that as it may, the argument was made we might break code. And so we backed off from that and said, you know what, this is a standard. We don't want to break code. Compatibility is important. Even if the only delta would be you should go back and change the library to add the proper no except override, let's back off and not force that on people this time. And so we just left it the default mostly as it was. We partly defaulted no except for people if it was already opted in, but we didn't go whole hog. Mm-hmm. Because we just, there's not going to be that much code broken. It probably deserves to be broken in the sense that it's wrong anyway. But let's not do that this time.
Interesting. I mean, and listening to all of this, this really goes back to the one question about design decisions. Mm-hmm. It seems to be an awful large amount of work, and thus you have these long spans of time in between decisions getting stamped as this is the way we're going to do it. Because of all these things you have to think about and juggle reality with, you know, how are people using these patterns, blah, blah, blah. Really interesting stuff. We're moving on to very interesting thing you mentioned briefly in our last talk, modules. Antaru asks, are they really coming? And if so, when do you expect the first implementation to show up?
Okay, so the modules proposal was to say, in Windows, you have dynamic link libraries, DLLs. In Unix flavors, you have shared libraries. Other platforms have the other various ideas of a bundle of object files that you could then share and load in different ways. Now, DLLs are dynamic. Shared libraries have different characteristics than Windows ones. So there's some variants out there, but wouldn't it be nice if we could talk about this in a standard way, talk about libraries, shared libraries, and modules in a standard way? Yes, it would be nice. Two people in particular who led the charge on trying to standardize something along that line, libraries and modules, were Pete Becker, who made one attempt and ran it up the hill. David van der Voorde of Edison Design Group also made an attempt, ran it up the hill. Pete's effort mostly ended with the conclusion that different operating systems did shared libraries sufficiently differently that there was no way to paper over the differences in a standard way. You'd be picking a winner, and it wouldn't work well or at all on other operating systems. That was one group's conclusion. Now, David took another approach which might have solved some of those problems, might not have. I think some of those problems just have not been solved yet in terms of differences in OSs. But the other problem with that, with the second one, was that it was much more inventive and creative, going much more beyond existing practice, which means the bar was higher to prove that it actually worked, you had an implementation, and there never was an implementation that really exercised all of it. It was too early and not baked enough for standardization. So it was actually one of the first things cut in 2006 in Portland. I think October 2006 is coming back to me. We had a serious talk in the committee, and we made our first set of cuts to the standard to bring in the scope and to try to make sure we get this thing done and remove the risky parts that weren't ready yet, and modules was part of that first set of cuts.
Mm-hmm. And, you know...
But people are still working on it, so the question was, will we ever get them?
Yeah.
I hope people continue working on it. So I don't know David's plans or Pete's plans or anyone else, mm-hmm. but it's still an interesting problem that anyone is welcome to come to the committee and show a proposal, especially with a proof of concept implementation that shows that that it can be done, that can give us portable modules.
Excellent. So OS, continuing on the modules theme, he basically asked the same question which you already answered, which was, could you briefly discuss module support didn't make into C++ OX, which you just did.
Okay.
His second question is, how can this work with templated code that has a lot of functionality in headers?
Yes. So modules can't really work well with headers.
Okay.
As soon as you start talking modules or libraries, putting templates in a library that are not header, you're talking export template or some close cousin. And that was the big feature that failed in the original standard that we completely yanked and is not even deprecated, is removed from the standard. Nobody knows how to solve that problem yet.
Okay.
Not in a commercially viable way that people can use, that real compilers that with real constraints can implement.
Okay. Continuing on with sort of the standardization stuff, David asks, why the long time in C++ standardization work? Will the next standard take as long as from getting from 98 to where we are today?
Mm-hmm.
Will MS or the C++ committee be working on getting newer developers to take a look and learn C++ along with managed languages? I don't know how that's related to that, so let's just step back and stick with this first question.
Why so long?
Why so long?
So first of all, yes, it took a long time. The good news is that the number of people who are asking that shows just how alive the C++ community still is. It is not a dead language, and there's a lot of interest in expanding it and maintaining it, and you want to be agile. So why did it take so long? Mm-hmm. 1998 to 2011 is 13 years. That's ages in software time. Now, in fairness, so will this next standard take as long? Doesn't need to. I don't know what it will actually take. It depends on what the goals are of the C++ community and the C++ committee and what we want to do. But let's just look back. One reason it took so long, the two major reasons. The first is for 5 years, from 1998 through 2003, we deliberately decided not to add any new features to the C++ standard. We did start work already during that time overlapping on the TR1, the Library Extensions Report, which was published, I think, in 2005 or 2006. Performance technical report, and a few other pieces of work. But we decided to have a moratorium on language extensions because in 1998, when the C++ standard shipped, it was way out ahead of implementations. No compiler implemented all of the C++ standard, including export, until EDG did it around 2003 or 2004, if I remember right, something like that. It was decided we better take some time and let implementations catch up and stabilize and not have the goalposts always moving. Now, having said that, okay, 2003, 2002 come along, we decide to do new work. Why did it take so long there? Largely, there's a couple of reasons, but largely, if I had to pick one particular reason, and not everyone will agree with me on this, so this is Herb's own opinion of having been part of the process and been at least one of the organizers and running in the show, is the one major reason that things took longer is concepts. We ended up not shipping them, and we poured countless committee hours, countless at-home hours of people working on it, of having separate meetings in addition to our regular three meetings a year, having telecons, papers, in trying to make this work, in doing proof of concept implementations. If you can't manage it like a project, because the standards committee is not a project team, but if we hadn't done that and just saved all that time, there was probably two elapsed years worth right there.
Wow.
I mean, it was a major part of the effort into C++ OX, and when it failed, we had nothing to show for it, but we still learned a lot, and we may do it in the future. So it's not completely wasted, but it did push it out. Now, part of it was because who knew when the next standard would be, everybody tried to get their feature into this one, right? And that's how you get scope creep in any project. It's like, if I don't know when vNext is going to be, I'm going to try to get everything into v this one. And so a lot of that dynamic happened too. So one of the things we're going to talk about post C++ OX is, do we want to have a regular release cycle, maybe every 3 or 4 years? Because then if people know there will be another ship train, then there will be a lot less pressure to bloat everything into one, which just expands it and everything takes longer. We may decide that it's time for another cooling off period, because today, as I sit here, there is not a compiler I know of that implements the entire C++ OX standard, which is just as well, because we just changed it a couple of months ago, again at our last meeting, so nobody can. I mean, it's currently just beginning its final international ballot, not even going to be published until later this year, so a cooling off period could be appropriate. These are the discussions we're going to have over the next few meetings. So in August in Bloomington, Illinois, we're going to have a discussion about that, as well as probably in Kona, which is the following meeting, in March of next year. And so first we need to structure, okay, what comes next? What do we want to have another revision? Do we want to start adding more language features? Should we do another library technical report, which was very successful?
Yeah.
And so those are the kinds of things that we'll look at. But hopefully we'll manage it so that it's not another 8 years.
Excellent. And you did mention in our talk last time that you were interested in the idea of sort of technical releases at a more quicker pace.
Yeah.
To quickly get, this is a bad design decision? How would it work in the real world? Analyze the data, move along.
The C++ committee is very inventive. If you look at different ISO committees, the different groups of people, they have different personalities. The group as a whole has a personality. Some, like the C committee or Fortran, tend to be much more restrained to implement just existing practice. Even there, C99 was kind of off in the weeds and pretty inventive with the floating point guys and the numerical work, where the sort of a subgroup with a special interest sort of took things over for a while and ran in one direction. But in general, it's a very disciplined, restrained committee. In C++, we like to invent stuff, because we have inventors on the committee who like to try new things, and so it becomes a forum for invention. Both models have worked. They each have their pros and cons. But because we tend to be a more inventive committee, one of the things I'm suggesting that we think about as a group is whether technical reports aren't the right way to go. Maybe the next thing we should do, if we're going to do another round of language extensions, which we still have to decide, perhaps the right vehicle for that in ISO is a technical report, which is not normative, but people still implement, just like they did the first technical report on library extensions. But it doesn't cast things in stone. You have much more freedom to change things. When we took things from the library TR into the standard, we could change our signatures, we could correct things much more easily without breaking people, because the technical report had things in a separate namespace, so the versioning and was much easier. You have much more flexibility in terms of what you actually adopt into the standard. So because we're more inventive, that may be the most appropriate vehicle within the ISO standards process to do that kind of experimentation, with a lot less risk for the committee and for customers and for people outside using C++.
So let's move on to a question that's, you know, more about how C++ is coded inside of Microsoft. And this is from Atle Iverson, and he asks, I'm not sure how much you're allowed to tell us, so at least he knows that, you know, we're on the Microsoft website. But I would love to hear some details about Microsoft Windows or MS Office in terms of how much C versus C++, which parts of C++ do they use. Google, he says, has released an official C++ coding standard. Do we have something similar inside of MS across big, giant customers of yours, Windows and Office? So basically, that's what he's asking.
So there's a grab bag of questions.
Yeah.
There.
So
let's sort of try to take them one at a time. You keep me honest and tell me you've got the.
I have them right here.
The list there, so you can remind me if I've missed anything.
Okay.
The first thing is which are C and C++ are they used a lot inside Microsoft? Yes. And in particular, even with Windows, it's probably fair to say that there's more C++ usage rather than just C with classes or C than I've seen in years past. So I think it's probably okay if I say that it's increasing. Now, there's also .NET usage, because if you look at a lot of the Office stuff in previous releases, I haven't looked lately, but for instance, for the previous current release that's now out there of Office, mm-hmm. A lot of the back-end stuff, the server-side stuff, is .NET oriented. Mm-hmm. And so there's a mix, but we're definitely seeing a lot of new C++ code being written. It's not just legacy maintenance. There's a lot of new C++ code that's being written right here in Microsoft, including right here on our team and our compiler team.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're going to be able to talk about that more as we start to be able to show what's in upcoming releases. What's one of the next ones? Cover it all.
No, that was a good one. He's also curious about, is there a coding standard inside of the company for C and C++?
So Andre Alexandrescu and I wrote C++ coding standards. That's the closest thing I know of in the community to a coding standards book. Mm. But it's not really, it's overlapping with what he's asking for. He's actually asking, I think, for a coding standard for, if I'm a Windows programmer, mm-hmm. or using Visual C++, what is the Microsoft recommended way, including not just standard C++, but all the Microsoft extensions like COM and Win32, that kind of thing, mm-hmm. of how to write a C++ application. That's on my to-do list. Mm. My boss keeps telling me I need to write that, or make sure it gets written. So sometime between now and, I don't know, if we're having this session a year from now and that still doesn't exist, then you can imagine I got some demerits somewhere. Input on that will be interesting, because you want to, I think it is important that we have a document like that where we set in the stake of the ground. We're not saying, hey, the whole industry should do what Microsoft does, but if you're a developer on Microsoft platforms and Microsoft tools and you want to do C++, not C, here is the recommended way, the recommended libraries, the recommended practices, everything from as detailed as smart pointers to as large as how are you supposed to write modules that interact with each other, DLLs, in an ABI-safe way.
Mm.
So that's something on my to-do list that I'm supposed to be pulling together. So yes, we need that. And so thanks for reaffirming the need for that, because it reminds me of something I've got to go do.
Excellent. So now a couple Boost-related questions, because I think that's
Boost.
A great community.
Love Boost.
So Corey asks, he says something like Boost file system is desperately needed, and I'm assuming he's talking about in our STL, mm-hmm. right, which doesn't exist. Is that what he's talking about, or let me just ask a question for him?
Well, so just read his question.
So here's his question. File system dash, something like Boost file system is desperately needed. So I was trying to draw, what exactly
I agree. Okay. It's desperately needed.
Sure.
In fact, when we were talking about let's talk standard. Post C++ OX, the only thing that we have, as a committee, have been thinking for sure is we would like some more library extensions. Maybe that's another library TR like we did. Maybe it's more than that if there's language too, but at least we'd like some more library extensions. For a while, we had a library TR2 bucket open, but then we decided to just merge that in with C++ OX, or defer that until after C++ OX. The only thing that got voted into that bucket so far is file system, Boost file system.
Mm.
Now, I think it was an earlier version of file system, because it's gone through 1, 2, 3 releases now that are a bit different. So it probably needs to be updated for a file system V3 or whatever the current one is at the time that we get to it. But it's on the top of the library working group's list of things to be added post C++ OX. Now, in terms of in our product, let me do a grab bag of questions, because there were a grab bag of questions about what's coming in our product next.
Yes.
What are we going to be doing in Visual C++? 2012 in terms of standards conformance, in terms of concurrency and parallelism. There were a lot of questions in that area. And if you want, I'm not going to make any product announcements here in this Channel 9 interview, sorry Charles, but definitely we just announced this week, we're just taping this after the event that was announcing the Build/Windows conference that we're having in September. I think it's the 13th to 16th, something
exactly.
like that.
Exactly.
So some people have been asking, is there going to be C++ content there? Because that conference sort of replaces PDC, I think is the idea. And PDC generally turned into a pretty managed languages conferences where C++ developers would come and kind of feel, is there much for me here? And there always was, but it really was not the mainstream. Mm-hmm. So definitely if you're interested in C++ technologies, come to Build, because we'll be talking a lot about C++. As well as managed stuff, and we'll be talking about C++ OX and what's in the next compiler. So come to Build, and you shall be satisfied.
And I just want to make one quick correction, because I don't want to edit, and that is Build is, at least this year, a replacement for this year's PDC, but in general, it is a new conference that is focusing specifically on Windows development.
That's my understanding, and
there will be PDCs in the future.
The whole decisions about what kinds of conferences are where is above my pay grade, but my understanding is, at least for this year, this is replacing PDC.
Right on.
And so it'll be an interesting conference with lots of cool stuff, including in C++.
Perfect. Now, Corey also asked about threading. One of his very terse questions, this guy's probably a C developer or something.
I noticed a lot of questions are from Corey, but if people voted them up, then people
agree. They certainly did. So his top four questions, like the earlier ones, were voted very high. So the final one from Corey, and this is what I'm going to throw at you. Threading. Thread pools, fine-grained task model, thread-safe containers.
Okay. So that leaves it pretty wide open, because he didn't say for Visual C++, for the standard, because he must be in the standard, because
yes.
In Visual C++ we already have PPL, which is the work stealing implementation concert. We've already shipped that in Visual Studio 2010, that's out now. Mm-hmm. But as far as the standard goes, thread pools almost made it into this standard. Mm. And there was some politics. And then because they were controversial, they were deferred. But again, as soon as we open up the library, you can expect that thread pools will be among the first things waiting at the starter's gate to be able to go into the next standard library. But in terms of some of the stuff that's already there, in C++ OX, we have not that much. We have basic threading and mutexes. We have std async, which launches an async operation. And we have futures, which is promises and futures, which are already pretty advanced for doing concurrent kind of work and doing at least the blocking, if not the continuous style, of programming within concurrency by getting asynchronous values. Now, that may not look like a whole lot when you say, oh, well, what about all this work stealing and other kinds of implementations? But there's already a lot there. I personally went to a lot of trouble at many committee meetings to make sure that this little feature called std async, which has three or four modes, it's synchronous, maybe on this thread, maybe on another thread, launch definitely on another thread, and so forth, to make sure that the default was launch somewhere on this or another thread, because that's the one that enables work stealing implementations. That's the one that enables you to write async, and by default, because it can run here or on another thread, it gives us all the maximum flexibility we have to where we can schedule it. Which means we can do some pretty good engineering under the covers. And again, we're not making a product announcement here, but expect to, since we worked hard to make sure that was in the standard that way, that very simple little feature of async turns out to have a lot of power to it. And so as those things come along in implementations, including ours, we expect to be able to do that in a very high-performance way.
Excellent.
That plays nice with things like work stealing and load balancing and all those kinds of things. So,
and again, that's at the library level.
That's at the library level.
So this kind of leads into a question that wasn't asked, but I'm going to ask it because it just was born right now.
Who voted your question up?
Well, hey, sorry, I'm Charles. I get to do this.
I see how this goes.
I get to ask all the dumb questions, okay? People can't vote them up. But my question would be, the way that they implemented async in C# at the language level was to work with the library, the task parallel library specifically, and they sort of brought that closer to the language, in terms of the compiler and what they're doing now at that level. It's actually a kind of an elegant thing to have the async keyword in the language and essentially do what you were just describing, which is, and they actually do it on one thread. But
It's for arranging your concurrent waiting.
That's exactly what it is. Continuation passing stuff. It's really just a sugarcoating.
It's more for almost coroutines. where you're defining the work that you need to do in a structured way, and then you can put the waypoints in knowing that, okay, if I have to wait for this one, I could be executing this other part of it. And there's nothing like that in Visual C++ right now.
Yeah.
You can code up something similar yourself using futures and the continuations, but you have to do it yourself. That's
sure. And so there's no thinking that that actually may have an async keyword.
Oh, there may be.
Maybe in the future. Sticking sort of on the boost, Ari, you know, I asked the question about, can you please comment on the influence of the boost community on the development of new features of the C++ language? He says, it seems that a lot of new C++ OS features, additions, have been adopted due to the wide use / acceptance of the features as part of the boost library. So boost library is sort of this testing ground.
Yes. And Boost is a testing ground. Boost is not the only source of extensions to the C++ standard library, never mind the language, because they are a library after all. But they have been very influential. A lot of good work has been there. A lot of good stuff has been proposed out of there, and I hope more will be post-C++ OX. But speaking of the language stuff, has it influenced the language? Yes. So here's one example. If you look at BoostBind, that's a library thing, but it allows you to make function objects on the fly much more conveniently than the standard let you do before with all that bind first, bind second, and compose stuff. Mm. But now, if you take a look at the language, Boost couldn't do things as a language. It had to do things as a library. It was very instructive to see where were the pain points where people who are writing modern C++ libraries, ignoring some of the super cutting-edge stuff, but just realistic but modern C++ libraries that had to be cross-platform like Boost, where were their pain points? What was just too hard that we could make easier in the language? You know I love talking about lambdas.
Mm-hmm.
Boost.lambda is a marvel of engineering. It makes certain kinds of short lambdas where you just write under 1, under 2, even simpler than polymorphic lambdas with lambda if you do them as lambda expressions.
Mm.
And it worked very well, A, if you didn't try to use things like member functions, which are at other basic language features that it just didn't work with at all, and B, if you spelled it exactly right the first time and didn't mind a 4-page error spew that told you almost nothing about what you did wrong if you spelled it a little wrong. So Boost Lambda was a superb library. It was shown as good as you could get with a library to the point where it showed why it had to be a language feature. This is the best you can do as a library. It's not good enough for widespread use. It's not good enough for an effective C++ book to recommend as a primary practice. It really needs to... I know, I tried to convince Scott early on, why don't you tell people to use Boost Lambda? It's just too hard. Have you seen the error messages? Yeah, and have you tried to use member functions anyway? What about multi-line lambdas? And then I gave up trying to convince him and bought him another beer. So, but lambda functions in the language were motivated largely by that experience and also were drew from that experience and seeing, oh, these are the things people did where it worked well. Now, what would it look like if it were in the language and part of the entire type system? Mm-hmm. And I think the result is pretty good.
Excellent. Now, talking about giant error messages, wasn't that one of the things that
concepts
was supposed to be? Templates,
yes.
You have templates and templates inside of templates and blah, blah, blah. You can have these error messages that make absolutely no sense at all. Or,
oh, they are baroque.
Yes.
Yes.
Okay.
So not baroque, it's baroque, yes.
Baroque, okay. So concepts could help that.
Concepts could help with that because what concepts would let you do is to say, I intend that this template parameter be able to do these things.
Exactly.
So on the calling side, you can say, hey, bub, you gave me something that can't do that stuff, and I can actually tell you what you did wrong. As opposed to, oh, deep in the bowels of this template, I tried to do this, and I'll give you these types you've never heard of and let you figure out what happened.
Exactly.
Yeah. And it's not always that bad, but template error messages sometimes can be just a little frustrating.
Yeah.
So I hope Concepts comes to solve that problem.
Excellent. Let's see here. We have, I believe, one more question, because I know you're very busy, and I don't want to keep you here too long.
What you got?
We have Alphonse. This is going back to sort of the a question which essentially will mean the question about VC Next, or perhaps the next standard, but I'm going to ask his question. Alphonse asks, uniform initialization.
Yes. Curly braces everywhere. Long live curly braces.
Yeah. Has the potential to radically reduce the quantity of typing necessary to create C++ types. It's the kind of thing, like lambdas, that will change how people write C++ code. What is the Visual Studio team's priority for implementing this feature, along with initializer lists?
So we're definitely aware of the of C++ OX stuff. So I as I mentioned before, the main answer is, hey, we're working hard, we're aware of this stuff, and we're working on it in committee, and we'll make product announcements later in the year. By the way, there'll be a lot of C++ content at Build, so I'm sure that many things may be talked about there, including some of our C++ OX work and plans. But just before that, remember that a lot of the C++ OX stuff is already in our compiler. I think I mentioned that last time.
Yes.
I think we were the first major compiler in the world to implement Lambda functions, and we were among the first to do R-value references, move semantics. So I offer that not as, oh, we're already doing everything we're going to. No, we know there's more to do. But look, Microsoft is taking this seriously. Other companies are taking this seriously, and this standard matters. And it is going to get implemented. And I look forward to the day when, as convener of the committee, I can point to a complete implementation somewhere. I don't think it's too far away.
Excellent.
But right now, the standard is, the ink is still wet. It's still in its final ballot. And it'll be a few months, maybe a few years, before major implementations have all caught up. But I think it's much better than it was back in 1998 when we shipped the first standard. The gap is much smaller. And implementations will catch up a lot faster. And to get complete implementations across the industry than with the previous standards. I'm very hopeful we'll see that in a fairly short amount of time.
Excellent. Now, this is the last question. I think it's a great last question.
Uh-huh.
So let's remove the Microsoft hat and the Visual Studio hat and stuff like that, which, of course, is hard to do since we're in your office at work. But Petke asked, and this was a very high-rated one, and it's sort of related to a different one, but it's a simple question. What is on the top of your mind, Herb, in terms of your post C++ 11 wish list? What is your wish list for the next version of C++ beyond where we are today? And I think that's what he's asking.
Yes.
What is on the top of your post C++ OS wish list?
It would be really nice if concepts worked. It would be really nice if we had modules. But there's a short list of high order features that might be nice to have, but nothing in particular. As I sit here, you know, I might think of a better thing and then put it in the comment on the C9 video. Mm-hmm. But nothing strikes me as must have for C++ next. The one answer I could give is probably going to be unsatisfying to him because it won't look like C++ anymore.
Mm-hmm.
But imagine, if you will, that C++ were exactly as it is today, exactly the same feature set, exactly the same flexibility and power and performance. And the only thing that was changed was the declaration syntax. It was simply C++ respelled, no other difference. So the declaration and expression syntax, if they were completely left to right, it would look like Pascal. It would be very quick to parse. A lot of the ambiguities in effective C++ would go away. A lot of the gotchas books you could just rip out a quarter of just by doing that. But would people, it's exactly, it's isomorphic to C++. You could write a converter that go back and forth to this other language, C++ prime.
Mm.
But it's a big source level breaking change. And it'll look so different that I don't know if it would be acceptable to a large, wide audience of people in the community. But it would be interesting if someday we could get to even just syntactically simpler a language, because it can be done. We know it can be done with the full power and performance of C++. The question is the code breakage. And that at that point, you really do have another language. Why not make other changes while we're at it? Mm-hmm. So there's a slippery slope there, but it's an interesting area to explore that I think will get some attention, you know, hopefully over the next decades as people think about where should native languages go.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, C++ is the preeminent one. And so its future right now, it's under active development, and we're looking forward to the standard being issued. And a lot of interesting things can happen in the near future about that. So I'll have to wait and see.
Excellent. Hey, thank you for taking the time to do this.
No problem. Thank you.
Taking questions from
Thanks for all the questions, by the way. Sorry we couldn't get to 100 of them.
Hey, they're all excellent questions. Thank you. We'll come back and see you again.
Okay. See you next time.
Cheers. Thank you.